welcome everyone to Sir Malachi's Menagerie History Part 14, where I have Life of Abraham Lincoln, written by Henry Ketchum's Parts 5 and 6. And like I said, we are live at 9:30 p.m. on Friday, May 14, 2010. And to get things started, here is the Life of Abraham Lincoln.
Chapter 17, The Backwoodsman at the Center of Eastern Culture. Lincoln's modesty made it impossible for him to be ambitious. He appreciated honors and desired them up to a certain point, but they did not, in his way of looking at them, seem to belong to him. He was slow to realize that he was of more than ordinary importance to the community. At the first Republican convention in 1856, when Fremont was nominated for president, 111 votes were cast for Lincoln as the nominee for vice president. The fact was published in the papers. When he saw the item, it did not enter his head that he was the man. He said, "There was a celebrated man of that name in Massachusetts. Doubtless it was he." In 1858, when he asked Douglas the fatal question at Freeport, he was simply killing off Douglas's aspirations for the presidency. It was with no thought of being himself the successful rival. Douglas had twice been a candidate for nomination before the Democratic Convention. Had it not been for this question, he would have been elected at the next following presidential election. As late as the early part of 1860, Lincoln vaguely desired the nomination for the vice presidency. He would have been glad to be the running mate of Seward, nothing more. Even this honor he thought to be beyond his reach, so slowly did he come to realize the growth of his own fame. The reports of the Lincoln-Douglas debates had produced a profound sensation in the West. They were printed in large numbers and scattered broadcast as campaign literature. Some Eastern men also had been alert to observe these events. William Cullen Bryan, the scholarly editor of the New York Evening Post, had shown keen interest in the debates. Even after the election, Lincoln did not cease the vigor of his criticisms. It will be remembered that before the formal debate, Lincoln voluntarily went to Chicago to hear Douglas and to answer him. He followed him to Springfield and did the same thing. He now, after the election of 1858, followed him to Ohio and answered his speeches in Columbus and Cincinnati. The Reverend Henry Ward Beecher, who was always watchful of the development of the anti-slavery sentiment, now invited Lincoln to lecture in Plymouth Church, Brooklyn. The invitation was accepted with the provision that the lecture might be a political speech. J.G. Holland, who doubtless knew whereof he wrote, declares that it was a great misfortune that Lincoln was introduced to the country as a rail splitter. Americans have no prejudice against humble beginnings, they are proud of the self-made man. But there is nothing in the ability to split rails which necessarily qualifies one for the demands of statesmanship. Some of his ardent friends, far more zealous than judicious, had expressed so much glory over Abe the rail splitter that it left the impression that he was little more than a rail splitter who could talk volubly and tell funny stories. This naturally alienated the finest culture east of the Alleghenies. It took years for the country to learn that Mr. Lincoln was not a boor. It took years for them to unlearn what an unwise and boyish introduction of a great man to the public had taught them. It took years for them to comprehend the fact that in Mr. Lincoln the country had the wisest, truest, gentlest, noblest, most sagacious president who had occupied the chair of state since Washington retired from it. When he reached New York, he found that there had been a change of plan, and he was to speak in the Cooper Institute, New York, instead of Beecher's Church. He took the utmost care in revising his speech, for he felt that he was on new ground and must do no less than his best. But though he made the most perfect intellectual preparation, the aesthetic element of his personal appearance was sadly neglected. He was angular and loose-jointed. He could not help that. He had provided himself, or had been provided, with a brand new suit of clothes, whether of good material or poor we cannot say, whether well-fitting or ill-fitting we do not know, though we may easily guess. But we do know that it had been crowded into a small carpet bag and came out a mass of wrinkles. And during the speech the collar or lapel annoyed both speaker and audience by persisting in rising up unbidden. These details are mentioned to show the difficulty of the task before the orator. In the audience and on the platform were many of the most brilliant and scholarly men of the metropolis. There were also large numbers who had come chiefly to hear the Westerner tell a lot of funny stories. The orator was introduced by Bryant. The speech was strictly intellectual from beginning to end. Though Lincoln was not known in New York, Douglas was. So he fittingly took his start from a quotation of Douglas. The speech cannot be epitomized, but its general drift may be divined from its opening and closing sentences. The quotation from Douglas was that which had been uttered at Columbus a few months before. Our fathers, when they framed the government under which we live, understood this question, the question of slavery, just as well and even better than we do now. To this proposition the orator assented. That raised the inquiry, what was their understanding of the question? This was a historical question and could be answered only by honest and painstaking research. Continuing, the speaker said, "Does the proper division of local from federal authority or anything in the Constitution forbid our federal government to control as to slavery in our federal territories?" Upon this, Senator Douglas holds the affirmative and the Republicans the negative. This affirmation and denial form an issue. And this issue, this question, is precisely what the text declares our fathers understood better than we. I defy anyone to show that any living man in the whole world ever did, prior to the beginning of the present century, and I might almost say prior to the beginning of the last half of the present century, declare that in his understanding, any proper division of local from federal authority or any part of the Constitution forbade the federal government to control as to slavery in the federal territories. To those who now so declare, I give not only our fathers who framed the government under which we live, but with them all other living men within the century in which it was framed among whom to search, and they shall not be able to find the evidence of a single man agreeing with them. One paragraph is quoted for the aptness of its illustration. But you will not abide the election of a Republican president. In that supposed event, you say you will destroy the Union, and then you say the great crime of having destroyed it will be upon us. That is cool. A highwayman holds a pistol to my ear and mutters through his teeth, "Stand and deliver, or I shall kill you, and then you will be a murderer." To be sure, what the robber demanded of me, my money, was my own, and I had a clear right to keep it. But it was no more my own than my vote is my own. And the threat of death to extort my money, and the threat of destruction to the Union to extort my vote, can scarcely be distinguished in principle. The speech reached its climax in its closing paragraph. Wrong as we think slavery is, we can yet afford to let it alone where it is, because that so much is due to the necessity arising from its actual presence in the nation. But can we, while our votes will prevent it, allow it to spread into the national territories and to overrun us here in the free states? If our sense of duty forbids this, then let us stand by our duty, fearlessly and effectively. Let us be diverted by none of those sophistical contrivances wherewith we are so industriously plied and belabored, contrivances such as groping for some middle ground between the right and the wrong, vain as the search for a man who will be neither a living man nor a dead man, such as the policy of don't care on a question about which all true men do care, such as Union appeals to beseech all true Union men to yield to disunionists, reversing the divine rule and calling not the sinners but the righteous to repentance, such as invocations to Washington, imploring men to unsay what Washington said and undo what Washington did. Neither let us be slandered from our duty by false accusations against us, nor frightened from it by menaces of destruction to the government, nor of dungeons to ourselves. Let us have faith that right makes might, and in that faith let us to the end dare to do our duty as we understand it. This speech placed Lincoln in the line of the presidency. Not only was it received with unbounded enthusiasm by the mass of the people, but it was a revelation to the more intellectual and cultivated. Lincoln afterwards told of a professor of rhetoric at Yale College who was present. He made an abstract of the speech and the next day presented it to the class as a model of cogency and finish. This professor followed Lincoln to Meriden to hear him again. The Tribune gave to the speech unstinted praise, declaring that no man ever before had made such an impression on his first appeal to a New York audience. The greatest compliment, because the most deliberate, was that of the committee who prepared the speech for general distribution. Their preface is sufficiently explicit. No one who has not actually attempted to verify its details can understand the patient research and historical labors which it embodies. The history of our earlier politics is scattered through numerous journals, statutes, pamphlets, and letters, and these are defective in completeness and accuracy of statement, and in indices and tables of contents. Neither can anyone who has not traveled over this precise ground appreciate the accuracy of every trivial detail, or the self-denying impartiality with which Mr. Lincoln has turned from the testimony of the fathers on the general question of slavery to present the single question which he discusses. From the first line to the last, from his premises to his conclusion, he travels with a swift, unerring directness which no logician ever excelled. An argument complete and full, without the affectation of learning, and without the stiffness which usually accompanies dates and details. A single, easy, simple sentence of plain Anglo-Saxon words contains a chapter of history that, in some instances, has taken days of labor to verify, and which must have cost the author months of investigation to acquire. Surely Mr. Bryan and Mr. Beecher and the rest had every reason for gratification that they had introduced this man of humble beginnings to so brilliant a New York audience. Lincoln went to Exeter, New Hampshire, to visit his son, who was in Phillips Academy preparing for Harvard College. Both going and returning, he made several speeches, all of which were received with more than ordinary favor. By the time he returned home, he was no longer an unknown man. He was looked on with marked favor in all that portion of the country which lies north of Mason and Dixon's line. Chapter 18, The Nomination of 1860. The subject of this chapter is the Republican convention that nominated Lincoln for the presidency. But for an intelligent narration of this, it is necessary to give a brief account of at least one of the three other important political conventions that were held that year. That one was the regular Democratic convention at Charleston. And certain other facts must also be narrated. Levin was working in two respects. The first is that the plan of secession and of setting up a southern nation founded upon slavery was not a sudden or impromptu thought. The evidence is conclusive that the plan had been maturing for years. Recent events had shown that slavery had reached the limit of its development so far as concerned the territory of the United States. The plan to annex Cuba as a garden for the culture of slavery had failed. California had been admitted as a free state. Slavery had been excluded from Kansas, although that territory had for 2 years been denied admission to the sisterhood of states. As the slave power was not content with any limitation whatever, its leaders now look for an opportunity to break up this present government and start a new one. At the time, December 1860, South Carolina passed the Ordinance of Secession, to be narrated later, certain things were said which must be quoted here. These utterances expose the spirit that animated the slave power long before Lincoln's election, long before he was even known in politics. Parker said that the movement of secession had been gradually culminating for a long series of years. Inglis endorsed this remark and added, "Most of us have had this matter under consideration for the last 20 years. Keats said, "I have been engaged in this movement ever since I entered political life." Rhett said, "The secession of South Carolina was not the event of a day. It is not anything produced by Mr. Lincoln's election or by the non-execution of the fugitive slave law. It is a matter which has been gathering head for 30 years. The election of Lincoln and Hamlin was the last straw on the back of the camel, but it was not the only one. The back was nearly broken before." The other important fact was the result of Lincoln's Freeport question. The answer of Douglas was, "I answer emphatically that, in my opinion, the people of a territory can, by lawful means, exclude slavery from its limits prior to the formation of a state constitution." This answer satisfied the Democrats of Illinois and secured his election to the Senate, as Lincoln predicted that it would. But it angered the Southern leaders beyond all reason, as Lincoln knew it would. When, therefore, the Democratic Convention met in Charleston, the first purpose of the Southern leaders was to defeat Douglas. In their judgment, he was not orthodox on slavery. He was far the strongest candidate before the convention, but he was not strong enough to secure the 2/3 votes which, under the rules of that party, were necessary to a choice. After 57 ballots and a corresponding amount of debating, the feeling of antagonism rising continually higher, the crisis came. The Southern delegates withdrew from the convention and appointed a convention of their own to be held in Richmond. This was done with the full knowledge that if it accomplished anything, it would accomplish the defeat of the party. It was probably done for this very purpose, to defeat the party, so as to give an excuse more or less plausible for carrying out the matured plan of secession, claiming to be injured or alarmed at the ascendancy of the Republican Party. Up to this point, at least, Lincoln had no aspirations for the presidency, but he did aspire to the United States Senate. He accepted his defeat by Douglas in 1858 as only temporary. He knew there would be another senatorial election in 4 years. When asked how he felt about this defeat, he turned it into a joke and said that he felt like a boy who had stubbed his toe too badly to laugh and he was too big to cry. He had thought of being nominated as vice president with Seward as president, which would have given him, if elected, a place in the Senate. He was glad of any possible prominence in the Chicago Convention, which was still in the future, for that would help his senatorial aspirations when the time came. But as to anything higher, he declared, "I must in all candor say that I do not think myself fit for the presidency," and he was an honest man. With the Senate still in view, he added, "I am not in a position where it would hurt me much not to be nominated for president on the national ticket. But I am where it would hurt me some for me not to get the Illinois delegates." Thus, at the beginning of the year 1860, Lincoln was in no sense in the race for the presidential nomination. About that time, a list of 21 names of possible candidates was published in New York. Lincoln's name was not on the list. A list of 35 was published in Philadelphia. Lincoln's name was not on that list. After the speech at Cooper Institute, the Evening Post mentioned Lincoln's name along with the others. That was the only case in the East. In Illinois, his candidacy developed in February and came to a head at the Republican State Convention at Decatur. Lincoln's name had been prominent in the preceding local conventions, and the enthusiasm was growing. Decatur was very near to the place where Thomas Lincoln had first settled when he came into the state. When Abraham Lincoln came into this convention, he was greeted with an outburst of enthusiasm. After order had been restored, the chairman, Governor Oglesby, announced that an old-time Macon County Democrat desired to make a contribution to the convention. The offer being accepted, a banner was borne up the hall upon two old fence rails. The hall was gaily decorated, and the inscription was, "Abraham Lincoln, the rail candidate, for president in 1860. Two rails from a lot of 3,000 made in 1830 by Thomas Hanks and Abe Lincoln, whose father was the first pioneer of Macon County. This incident was the means of enlarging the sobriquet Honest Abe to Honest Old Abe, the rail splitter. The enthusiasm over the rail spread far and wide. That he had split rails, and that he had even done it well, was no test of his statesmanship. But it was a reminder of his humble origin, and it attached him to the common people, between whom and himself there had always been a warm feeling of mutual sympathy. The Democratic Convention had, after the bolt of the extreme Southerners, adjourned to Baltimore, where they duly nominated Douglas. What anyone could have done for the purpose of restoring harmony in the party, he did. But the breach was too wide for even that astute politician to bridge over. Lincoln grasped the situation. It was what he had planned for 2 years before, and he confidently expected just this breach. Douglas never can be president, he said. He fully understood the relentless bitterness of the slave power, and he well knew that whatever Douglas might do for the Northern Democrats, he had lost all influence with the southern branch of that party. So Lincoln told his little story and serenely awaited the result. The Second Republican National Convention met in Chicago, May 16, 1860. A temporary wooden structure called a wigwam had been built for the purpose. It was for those days a very large building and would accommodate about 10,000 people. The man who was, far and away, the most prominent candidate for the nomination was William H. Seward of New York. He had the benefit of 30 years of experience in political life. He was a man of wide learning, fine culture, unequaled as a diplomatist. He was a patriot, a statesman, and loyal to the principles of the Republican Party. He had a plurality of the delegates by a wide margin, though not a majority. It seemed a foregone conclusion that he would be nominated. Horace Greeley, who was determinedly opposed to him, gave up the contest and telegraphed to his paper that Seward would be nominated. The opposition, he said, could not unite on any one man. The next most prominent name was Lincoln. He had the full delegation of Illinois, who at Decatur had been instructed to vote for him as the first and only choice of the state. He had many votes, too, from the neighboring states. In addition to these two candidates before the convention, there were a half dozen others, all favorite sons of their own state, but who at no time developed any great strength. The only point against Seward was his inability to carry certain doubtful states. If the split in the Democratic Party had not occurred, and if the election were to be carried according to the experience of 1856, it would be necessary for the Republicans to carry certain states which they had at that time failed to carry. The most available states were Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Indiana, and Illinois. Under favorable circumstances, these could be carried. Seward's long public career had inevitably caused antagonisms, and these necessary states he could not carry. The question with his opponents then was, who is most likely to carry these states? Lincoln's popularity in three of the four states named singled him out as the rival of Seward. It then became only a question whether the opposition to Seward could or could not unite in the support of Lincoln. At this point there came in a political ruse which has been often used in later years. Seward's friends had taken to Chicago a small army of clackers numbering nearly or quite 2,000. These were distributed through the audience and were apparently under orders to shout whenever Seward's name was mentioned. This gave the appearance of spontaneous applause and seemed to arouse great enthusiasm for the candidate. Lincoln's friends soon came to understand the situation and planned to beat their rivals at their own game. They sent out into the country and secured two men with phenomenal voices. It was said with playful exaggeration that these two men could shout so as to be heard across Lake Michigan. They were made captains of two stentorian bands of followers. These were placed on opposite sides of the auditorium and were instructed to raise the shout at a preconcerted signal and keep it up as long as desired. The plan worked. Leonard Sweat describes the result. Caleb B. Smith of Indiana then seconded the nomination of Lincoln, and the West came to his rescue. No mortal before ever saw such a scene. The idea of us Hoosiers and suckers being out-screamed would have been as bad to them as the loss of their man. 5,000 people at once leaped to their seats, women not wanting in the number, and the wild yell made soft vesper breathings of all that had preceded. No language can describe it. 1,000 steam whistles, 10 acres of hotel gongs, a tribe of Comanches headed by a choice vanguard from Pandemonium might have mingled in the scene unnoticed. A dramatic scene had occurred at the adoption of the platform. When the first resolution was read, Joshua E. Giddings, an old-time abolitionist of the extreme type, moved as an amendment to incorporate the words from the Declaration of Independence, which announced the rights of all men to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The hostility to this amendment was not so much owing to an objection to the phrase as to its being introduced upon the motion of so extreme a partisan as Giddings. The new party was made up of men of various old parties, and it was important that the moderate Democrats should not be antagonized by the extreme abolitionists. The motion was lost by a decided vote, and the old man, almost broken-hearted, left the hall amid the protestations of his associates. There then came to his rescue a young man about 36 years of age, who was then not widely known, but who since has more than once decidedly influenced Republican conventions at a critical stage of the proceedings. It was George William Curtis. When the second resolution was under consideration, he presented the amendment of Giddings in a form slightly modified. He then urged it in an impassioned speech, and by his torrent and eloquence carried the enthusiasm of the convention with him. "I have to ask this convention," he concluded, "whether they are prepared to go upon record before the country as voting down the words of the Declaration of Independence. I rise simply to ask gentlemen to think well before, upon the free prairies of the West, in the summer of 1860, they dared to wince and quail before the assertions of the men of Philadelphia in 1776. before they dare to shrink from repeating the words that these great men enunciated. The amendment was adopted in a storm of applause. Giddings, overjoyed at the result, returned to the hall. He threw his arms about Curtis and with deep emotion exclaimed, "God bless you, my boy. You have saved the Republican Party. God bless you." The candidates in those days were simply announced without speeches of glorification. Mr. Everts of New York named Seward and Mr. Judd of Illinois named Lincoln. The names of half a dozen favored sons were offered by their states, the most important being Bates of Missouri. After the seconding of the nominations, the convention proceeded to the ballot. There were 465 votes, and 233 were necessary for a choice. On the first ballot, Seward received 173.5 and Lincoln 102. The rest were scattering. On the second ballot, Seward received 184.5 and Lincoln 181. Seward was still ahead, but Lincoln had by far made the greater gain. On the third ballot, Seward received 180 and Lincoln 231.5. But this ballot was not announced. The delegates kept tally during the progress of the vote. When it became evident that Lincoln was about elected, while the feeling of expectancy was at the highest degree of tension, an Ohio delegate mounted his chair and announced a change of 4 Ohio votes from Chase to Lincoln. There was instantly a break. On every side, delegates announced a change of vote to Lincoln. The result was evident to everyone, and after a moment's pause, the crowd went mad with joy. One spectator has recorded the event. The scene which followed baffles all human description. After an instant's silence, which seemed to be required to enable the assembly to take in the full force of the announcement, the wild and mightiest yell, for it can be called by no other name, burst forth from 10,000 voices which were ever heard from mortal throats. This strange and tremendous demonstration, accompanied with leaping up and down, tossing hats, handkerchiefs, and canes recklessly into the air, with the waving of flags, and with every other conceivable mode of exultant and unbridled joy, continued steadily and without pause for perhaps 10 minutes. It then began to rise and fall in slow and billowing bursts, and for perhaps the next 5 minutes, these stupendous waves of uncontrollable excitement, now rising into the deepest and fiercest shouts, and then sinking like the groundswell of the ocean into hoarse and lessening murmurs, rolled through the multitude. Every now and then it would seem as though the physical power of the assembly was exhausted, when all at once a new hurricane would break out, more prolonged and terrific than anything before. If sheer exhaustion had not prevented, we don't know but the applause would have continued to this hour. During all this time, Lincoln remained at Springfield, where he was in telegraphic communication with his friends at Chicago, though not by private wire. At the time of his nomination, he had gone from his office to that of the Sangamon Journal. A messenger boy came rushing up to him, carrying a telegram and exclaiming, "You are nominated." The friends who were present joyously shook his hand and uttered their eager congratulations. Lincoln thanked them for their good wishes and said, "There is a little woman on 8th Street who will be glad to hear this, and I guess I'll go up and carry her the news." Pocketing the telegram, he walked home. At the wigwam, the news spread quickly. A man had been stationed on the roof as a picket. He shouted, "Hallelujah! Abe Lincoln is nominated. Fire the cannon." The frenzy of joy spread to the immense throng of citizens outside the wigwam, then through the city, then through the state, then through the neighboring states. At Washington that night, someone asked, "Who is this man Lincoln, anyhow?" Douglas replied, "There won't be a tar barrel left in Illinois tonight." With unprecedented enthusiasm, the Republican Party started on this campaign, which led to its first victory in the election of Abraham Lincoln of Illinois and Hannibal Hamlin of Maine. Chapter 19. The Election. There are two things which made the campaign of 1860 paradoxical, so to speak. One was that the nomination was equivalent to an election unless unforeseen difficulties should arise. The other was that this election might be used by the extreme Southern Democrats as an excuse for precipitating war. They threatened this. After the nomination, the committee of the convention duly called on Lincoln to give him the formal notification. This committee included some names that were at that time, and still more so later, widely known. Among them were three from Massachusetts: Ashman, then governor and chairman of the Chicago Convention; Bowles, editor of the Springfield Republican; and Boutwell. There were also Gideon Welles, Carl Schurz, Francis P. Blair, and W. M. Everts. The chairman of this committee notified Lincoln in a brief speech, to which he responded with equal brevity. Even these few words impressed his hearers with a sense of dignity and manliness which they were only too glad to perceive. Said Mr. Boutwell, "Why, sir, they told me he was a rough diamond. Nothing could have been in better taste than that speech." One who had opposed Lincoln in the convention said, "We might have done a more daring thing than nominate him, but we certainly could not have done a better thing." Carl Schurz evidently shared this feeling. Judge Kelly of Pennsylvania was a very tall man and was proud of the fact. During the brief ceremony, he and Lincoln had been measuring each other with the eye. At the conclusion of the ceremony, the president-elect demanded, "What's your height?" "6 feet 3." "What is yours, Mr. Lincoln?" "6 feet 4." "Then," said the judge, "Pennsylvania bows to Illinois." "My dear man, for many years my heart has been aching for a president I could look up to, and I have found him at last in a land where we thought there were none but little giants." The general feeling of the committee was that the convention had made no mistake. This feeling quickly spread throughout the entire party. Some of Seward's friends wanted him to run on an independent ticket. It is to his credit that he scouted the idea. The Democrats, at least the opponents of Lincoln, were divided into three camps. The first was the regular party headed by Douglas. The second was the bolting party of fire eaters who nominated Breckinridge. The third was the party that nominated Bell and Everett. This was wittily called the kangaroo ticket, because the tail was the most important part. Lincoln's popular vote at the November election was about 40% of the total. It was plain that if his supporters held together and his opponents were divided, he could readily get a plurality. There were attempts on the part of the opponents of Lincoln to run fusion tickets in New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania so as to divert the electoral votes from him. But these came to nothing more than that New Jersey diverted 3 of her 7 electoral votes. A curious feature of the campaign was that all 4 candidates declared emphatically for the Union. Breckinridge, who was the candidate of the Southern Disunionists, wrote, "The Constitution and the equality of the states, these are symbols of everlasting union." Lincoln himself could hardly have used stronger language. Some people were doubtless deceived by these protestations, but not Douglas. He declared, "I do not believe that every Breckinridge man is a disunionist, but I do believe that every disunionist in America is a Breckinridge man." During the period of nearly 6 months between nomination and election, Lincoln continued simple, patient, wise. He was gratified by the nomination. He was not elated, for he was not an ambitious man. On the contrary, he felt the burden of responsibility. He was a far-seeing statesman, and no man more distinctly realized the coming tragedy. He felt the call of duty, not to triumph, but to sacrifice. This was the cause of his seriousness and gravity of demeanor. There was no unnecessary change in his simple manners and unpretentious method of living. Friends and neighbors came, and he was glad to see them. He answered the doorbell himself and accompanied visitors to the door. Some of his friends, desiring to save his strength in these little matters, procured a Negro valet, Thomas by name. But Abraham continued to do most of the duties that by right belonged to Thomas. Someone sent him a silk hat, that he might go to Washington with headgear equal to the occasion. A farmer's wife knit him a pair of yarn stockings. Hundreds of such attentions, kind in intent, grotesque in appearance, he received with that kindness which is the soul of courtesy. There was a woman at whose modest farmhouse he had once dined on a bowl of bread and milk, because he had arrived after everything else had been eaten up. She came into Springfield to renew her apologies and to remind him that he had said that that repast was good enough for the president. While he commanded the respect of Bryant, Schurz, Boutwell, and such, he was at the same time the idol of the plain people, whom he always loved. He once said that he thought the Lord particularly loved plain people, for he had made so many of them. Shortly after his nomination, he was present at a party in Chicago. A little girl approached timidly. He asked encouragingly if he could do anything for her. She replied that she wanted his name. He looked about and said, "But here are other little girls. They will feel badly if I give my name only to you." She said there were 8 of them in all. "Then," said he, "get me 8 sheets of paper and a pen and ink, and I will see what I can do for you." The materials were brought, and in the crowded drawing room he sat down, wrote a sentence and his name on each sheet of paper. Thus he made 8 little girls happy. The campaign was one of great excitement. His letter of acceptance was of the briefest description and simply announced his adherence to the platform. For the rest, his previous utterances in the debates with Douglas, the Cooper Institute speech, and other addresses were in print, and he was content to stand by the record. He showed his wisdom in refusing to be diverted or to allow his party to be diverted from the one important question of preventing the further extension of slavery. The public were not permitted to lose sight of the fact that this was the real issue. The Chicago Wigwam was copied in many cities. Temporary wooden structures were erected for Republican meetings. These did good service as rallying centers. Then the campaign biographers began to appear. It was said that by June he had no less than 52 applications to write his biography. One such book was written by W.D. Howells, not so famous in literature then as now. Lincoln furnished a sketch of his life, an autobiography so-called. This contains only about 500 words. Its brevity is an indication of its modesty. Nor was there any lack of eulogistic music. Among the writers of campaign songs were J.G. Whittier and E.C. Stedman. The parading contingent of the party was represented by the wideawakes. The uniform was as effective as simple. It consisted of a cadet cap and cape, both made of oil cloth, and a torch. The first company was organized in Hartford. It had escorted Lincoln from the hotel to the hall and back again when he spoke in that city in February after his Cooper Institute speech. The idea of this uniform company of cadets captivated the public fancy. Bands of wideawakes were organized in every community in the North. At the frequent political rallies, they poured in by thousands and tens of thousands, a very picturesque sight. The original band in Hartford obtained the identical maul with which Lincoln had split those rails in 1830. It is now in the collection of the Connecticut Historical Society in Hartford. Though Lincoln had much to cheer him, he had also his share of annoyances. One of his discouragements was so serious, and at this day it appears so amazing, that it is given nearly in full. A careful canvass had been made of the voters of Springfield, and the intention of each voter had been recorded. Lincoln had the book containing this record. He asked his friend Mr. Bateman, the state superintendent of public instruction, to look through the book with him. They noted particularly those who might be considered leaders of public morals, clergymen, officers, or prominent members of the churches. When the memorandum were tabulated, after some minutes of silence, he turned a sad face to Mr. Bateman and said, "Here are 23 ministers of different denominations, and all of them are against me but 3. And here are a great many prominent members of the churches, a very large majority of whom are against me. Mr. Bateman, I am not a Christian. God knows I would be one, but I have carefully read the Bible, and I do not so understand this book." He drew from his pocket a New Testament. "These men well know that I am for freedom in the territories, freedom everywhere as far as the Constitution and laws will permit, and that my opponents are for slavery. They know this, and yet with this book in their hand, in the light of which human bondage cannot live a moment, they are going to vote against me. I do not understand it at all." After a long pause, he added with tears, "I know there is a God, and that he hates injustice and slavery. I see the storm coming, and I know that his hand is in it. If he has a place and work for me, and I think he has, I believe I am ready. I am nothing, but truth is everything. I know I am right because I know that liberty is right, for Christ teaches it, and Christ is God. I have told them that a house divided against itself cannot stand, and Christ and reason say the same, and they will find it so. Douglas doesn't care whether slavery is voted up or voted down, but God cares, and humanity cares, and I care. And with God's help, I shall not fail. I may not see the end, but it will come, and I shall be vindicated. And these men will find that they have not read their Bibles aright. After another pause, doesn't it appear strange that men can ignore the moral aspects of this contest? A revelation could not make it plainer to me that slavery or the government must be destroyed. The future would be something awful as I look at it, but for this rock, the testament which he was holding, on which I stand. Especially with the knowledge of how these ministers are going to vote. It seems as if God had borne with this thing slavery until the very teachers of religion had come to defend it from the Bible and to claim for it a divine character and sanction. And now the cup of iniquity is full, and the vials of wrath will be poured out. Lincoln did not wear his heart upon his sleeve. On the subject of religion, he was reticent to a degree. Peter Cartwright had called him an atheist. There was a wide, if not general, impression that he was not a religious man. This did him great injustice. It is for this reason that his remarks to Mr. Bateman are here quoted at length. From his early boyhood, from before the time when he was at great pains to have a memorial sermon for his mother, he was profoundly, intensely religious. He did no injustice to any other man. He did not do justice to himself. The election occurred on the 6th day of November. The vote was as follows. Lincoln received 1,866,452 popular votes and 180 electoral votes. Douglas received 1,375,157 popular votes and 12 electoral votes. Breckinridge received 847,953 popular votes and 72 electoral votes. Bell received 590,631 popular votes and 39 electoral votes. Lincoln carried all of the free states, excepting that in New Jersey the electoral vote was divided, he receiving 4 out of 7. In the 15 slave states he received no electoral vote. In 10 states not one person had voted for him. Of the 303 electoral votes, he had received 180, while the aggregate of all against him numbered 123, giving him an absolute majority of 57. The electoral vote was duly counted in the joint session of the two houses of Congress, February 13, 1861, and it was officially announced that Abraham Lincoln, having received a majority of the votes of the presidential electors, was duly elected President of the United States for 4 years, beginning March 4, 1861. One circumstance is added which may be of interest to the reader. This was published after his death by his personal friend Noah Brooks. It is given in Lincoln's own words. It was just after my election in 1860, when the news had been coming in thick and fast all day, and there had been a great hurrah, boys, so that I was well tired out and went home to rest, throwing myself upon a lounge in my chamber. Opposite to where I lay was a bureau with a swinging glass upon it, and looking in that glass, I saw myself reflected nearly at full length. But my face, I noticed, had two separate and distinct images, the tip of the nose of the one being about 3 inches from the tip of the other. I was a little bothered, perhaps startled, and I got up and looked in the glass. But the illusion vanished. On lying down again, I saw it a second time, plainer if possible than before. And then I noticed that one of the faces was a little paler, say 5 shades, than the other. I got up and the thing melted away, and I went off and in the excitement of the hour forgot all about it, nearly, but not quite. For the thing would once in a while come up and give me a little pang, as though something uncomfortable had happened. When I went home I told my wife about it, and a few days after I tried the experiment again, when sure enough the thing came back again. But I never succeeded in bringing the ghost back after that, though I once tried very industriously to show it to my wife, who was worried about it somewhat. She thought it was a sign that I was to be elected to a second term of office, and that the paleness of one of the faces was an omen that I should not see life through that last term. The incident is of no interest, excepting in so far as everything about Lincoln is of interest. The phenomenon is an optical illusion not uncommon. One image, the paler or more indistinct one, is reflected from the surface of the glass, while the other is reflected from the silvered back of the glass. Though Lincoln understood that it was an optical illusion, yet the thought of it evidently weighed on him. Otherwise, he would not have repeated the experiment several times, nor would he have told of it to different persons.
Before I continue on with part six, I want to remind you to listen in to the 104th edition of the Patriot Hour on Sunday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, where General Rachel and I try to make sense out of all this nonsense. I'm going to play a couple of tunes before I play part six for you. First one is Glenn Miller's Stardust. Patrol by Glenn Miller. Song before I begin part six of Life of Abraham Lincoln, a little Irish montage from Riverdance. quick reminder to listen into the 104th edition of the Patriot Hour on Sunday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. On Sunday. And now, part 6 of The Life of Abraham Lincoln, written by Henry Ketchum.
Chapter 20, Four Long Months. 4 long months would not ordinarily be considered a long period of time. But when one is compelled to see the working of a vast amount of mischief, powerless to prevent it, and knowing oneself to be the chief victim of it all, the time is long. Such was the fate of Lincoln. The election was not the end of a life of toil and struggle, it was the beginning of a new career of sorrow. The period of 4 months between the election and inauguration could not be devoted to rest or to the pleasant plans for a prosperous term of service. There developed a plan for the disruption of the government. The excuse was Lincoln's election, but he was for 4 months only a private citizen. He had no power. He could only watch the growing mischief and realize that he was the ultimate victim. Buchanan, who was then president, had a genius for doing the most unwise thing. He was a northern man with southern principles, and this may have unfitted him to see things in their true relations. He certainly was putty in the hands of those who wished to destroy the Union, and his vacillation precisely accomplished what they wished. Had he possessed the firmness and spirit of John A. Dix, who had ordered, "If any man attempts to haul down the American flag, shoot him on the spot." Had he a modicum of the patriotism of Andrew Jackson, had he a tithe of the wisdom and manliness of Lincoln, secession would have been nipped in the bud, and vast treasures of money and irreparable waste of human blood would have been spared. Whatever the reasons may have been, incapacity, obliquity of moral and political vision, or absolute championship of the cause of disruption, certain it is that the Southern fire-eaters could not have found a tool more perfectly suited to their purpose than James Buchanan. He was the center of one of the most astonishing political cabals of all history. Lincoln did not pass indiscriminate condemnation upon all men of Southern sympathies. At the time of which we are now writing, and consistently up until the end of his life, he made a marked distinction between the rank and file of the Confederates on the one hand, and those leaders who, on the other hand, had, while in the service of the United States government, sought to accomplish its destruction. The first were revolutionists. They were so regarded generally in Europe, and he believed they were sincere. He regarded them as having the spirit of revolutionists. For the second, who held office under, drew pay from, and were under solemn oath to support the government, while they were using the vantage of their official position to violate the Constitution and disrupt that government, there is but one word, and that is a strong one: traitors. This was Lincoln's judgment of the men. Let us now briefly describe the situation. Jefferson Davis, though not a member of Buchanan's cabinet, was probably the most influential of the Southerners in Washington. He had been Secretary of War under Pierce, and it was he who had inaugurated the policy of stripping the North for the purpose of strengthening the military defenses of the South. This policy was vigorously pursued under his successor. The only person to call a halt to the treasonable proceedings was General Winfield Scott. He was residing in New York City, and on October 29th addressed a letter to President Buchanan containing his views upon the situation. A day or two later, he added supplementary considerations addressed to the Secretary of War. He set forward with much clearness and force the necessity of garrisoning the southern forts before they should be lost. His letter had its fault, but it accomplished one thing. It showed that there was one high official who was in earnest in the discharge of his duties, and with whom it was not safe to trifle. President Buchanan sent in his annual message to Congress December 3, 1860. In his discussion of the subject of slavery, he recommended that it be extended to the territories, the very thing the people had just voted should not be done. Concerning secession, he said for substance that the government had the power to suppress revolt, but that it could not use that power in reference to South Carolina, the state then under consideration. The secessionists had apparently tied the hands of the executive effectually. Now observe what was going on in the cabinet. Louis Cass had been Secretary of State, but resigned in indignation over the inaction of the President when he failed to secure the forts in Charleston Harbor. He was succeeded by Jeremiah S. Black, who as Attorney General had given to Buchanan an opinion that the federal government had no power to coerce a seceding state. Hal Cobb, Secretary of the Treasury, having wasted the funds and destroyed the credit of the government, resigned and left an empty treasury. John B. Floyd, Secretary of War, was not the least active. He carried out fully the plan which Jefferson Davis had begun to operate several years before. The northern arsenals were stripped of the arms and ammunition which were sent south for storage or use. The number of regular troops was small, but the few soldiers there were he scattered in distant places so that they should be out of reach. They were not to be available for the use of the government until the conspirators should have time to complete their work. It was Floyd whom an emotional Virginian later eulogized. With quite as much truth as poetry, he declared that the Secretary of War thwarted, objected, resisted, and forbade the efforts of General Scott. This same admirer of Floyd further declared that if Scott's plans had been adopted and his measures executed, the conspiracy would have been defeated and it would have been impossible to form the Southern Confederacy. Not worse, perhaps, but more flagrant, was the action of the Secretary of the Interior, Thompson, of Mississippi. With the advice and consent of Buchanan, he left his post at Washington to visit North Carolina and help on the work of secession, and then returned and resumed his official prerogatives under the government he had sworn to sustain. This is so grave a matter that a passage from the diary of Mr. Clingman is here inserted, quoted by Nicolai and Hay. About the middle of December, 1860, I had occasion to see the Secretary of the Interior on some official business. On my entering the room, Mr. Thompson said to me, "Clingman, I am glad you have called, for I intended presently to go up to the Senate to see you. I have been appointed a commissioner by the state of Mississippi to go down to North Carolina to get your state to secede." I said to him, "I did not know you had resigned." He answered, "Oh no, I have not resigned." Then I replied, "I suppose you resign in the morning." "No," he answered, "I do not intend to resign. Mr. Buchanan wishes all of us to hold on and go out with him on the 4th of March." "But," said I, "does Mr. Buchanan know for what purpose you are going to North Carolina?" "Certainly," he said, "he knows my object." In the meanwhile, Isaac Toucey, the Secretary of the Navy, had been prevailed on to put the Navy out of reach. The armed vessels were sent to the ends of the earth. At the critical period, only two were available to the government. What was going on in Congress? That body was very busy doing nothing. Both Senate and House raised committees for the purpose of devising means of compromise. But every measure of concession was promptly voted down by the body that had appointed the committees. In the Senate, the slave power was in full control. In the House, the slave power was not in majority. But they enjoyed this advantage that they were able to work together, while the constituency of the free states were usually divided among themselves. And in joint session, the extreme pro-slavery men were always able to prevent anything from being accomplished. This was all they wished. They had sufficient pledges from the President that nothing would be done before the 4th of March, and it was their belief that by that time the new power would have so good a start that it could treat with the United States on equal terms. On January 7th, 1861, Senator Yulee of Florida wrote, "By remaining in our places until the 4th of March, it is thought we can keep the hands of Mr. Buchanan tied and disable the Republicans from effecting any legislation which will strengthen the hands of the incoming administration." On December 14th, 30 of the Southern senators and representatives had issued a circular to the constituents. They said that the arguments were exhausted, that all hope of relief was extinguished, that the Republicans would grant nothing satisfactorily, and that honor, safety, and independence of the Southern people required the organization of a Southern Confederacy. South Carolina was the first to act. 6 days later, that state passed the ordinance of secession. Upon this, one of the extreme traitors was forced out of the cabinet. Floyd, the mischievous Secretary of War, was displaced by Holt, a loyal man. Floyd, however, had done nearly, if not quite, all the mischief he could have done. Stanton had already replaced Black as Attorney General. The conspirators then held a caucus. It is supposed that this caucus was held in one of the rooms of the Capitol. At all events, it was held in the city of Washington. It was composed of the extreme Southern congressmen. It decided to recommend immediate secession, the formation of the Southern Confederacy, and not least, that congressmen should remain in their seats to keep the president's hands tied. The committee to carry out these plans consisted of Jefferson Davis, Slidell, and Mallory. By the first day of February, 7 states had passed ordinances of secession. This is about what was going on during the 4 months Lincoln was waiting for the appointed time when he should enter upon his duties. It was not unlike looking upon a house he was shortly to occupy and seeing vandals applying the torch and axe of destruction while he was not permitted to go to the rescue, all the while knowing he would be held accountable for the preservation of the structure. So Lincoln saw this work of destruction going on at Washington. It was plain that the mischief ought to be and could be stopped. But Buchanan would not stop it. And Lincoln was, until March 4th, a private citizen and could do nothing. The bitterest part of it all was that all the burden would fall on him. As soon as he should become president, it would be his duty to save the government which these men were now openly destroying. Miss Tarbell has recorded a conversation between Lincoln and his friend Judge Gillespie, which took place in Springfield early in January, in which the former expressed his feelings upon the situation. "Gillespie," said he, "I would willingly take out of my life a period in years equal to the 2 months which intervene between now and the inauguration to take the oath of office now. Why? Because every hour adds to the difficulties I am called upon to meet, and the present administration does nothing to check the tendency towards dissolution. I, who have been called to meet this awful responsibility, am compelled to remain here, doing nothing to avert it or lessen its force when it comes to me. Every day adds to the situation and makes the outlook more gloomy. Secession is being fostered rather than repressed. I have read, upon my knees, the story of Jessamine, where the Son of God prayed in vain that the cup of bitterness might pass from him. I am in the Garden of Jessamine now, and my cup of bitterness is full to overflowing." It was indeed hard to keep his patience and self-control. He was importuned for expressions of his views, for messages conciliatory to the South, for some kind of a proclamation which might quiet the public feeling. But he saw clearly that anything he might say at that time, no matter how wise or conciliatory, would surely be misused as fuel to add to the flames. While therefore he talked and wrote freely to his friends, he made no public announcement. He merely referred to his record. His opinions had been fully expressed in the debates with Douglas and in other speeches. There were 4 important points as to his future policy. The Union should be preserved, the Constitution should be upheld, and the fugitive slave law, being a law, should be enforced. But slavery should not be extended. These fully covered all the necessary points of the subject, and beyond these he would not go. He who would control others must first control himself. It is hard to imagine a more severe test than this imposed upon Lincoln during this period of waiting. He made his preparations in silence, and not an injudicious word escaped him. He left his home for Washington on the 11th day of February. But though he made several speeches on the way, he did not outline his policy until he read his inaugural address on the 4th of March.
Chapter 21, Journey to Washington. The long period of waiting approached its end. Most of the states and cities lying between Springfield and Washington invited him officially to visit them on his way to the Capitol. It was decided that he should accept as many as possible of these invitations. This would involve a zigzag route and require considerable time. The invitation of Massachusetts he declined on account of the pressures of time. Maryland was conspicuous by its omission of courtesy. 2 private citizens of Baltimore invited him to dinner, that was all. The presidential party consisted of about a dozen all told. They were to leave Springfield February 11th and to consume about 2 weeks on the way. It was a dreary morning, partly drizzling and partly snowing. A large crowd of neighbors had assembled at the dingy railway station to bid him goodbye. The process of handshaking was interrupted by the arrival of the train. After the party had entered the car, the president reappeared on the rear platform. He raised his hand to speak, but did not utter a word until the solemn silence became painful. Then, with great tenderness and seriousness, he spoke as follows. "My friends, no one, not in my situation, can appreciate my feeling of sadness at this parting. To this place and the kindness of these people, I owe everything. Here I have lived a quarter of a century and have passed from a young to an old man. Here my children have been born and one is buried. I now leave not knowing when or whether ever I may return, with a task before me greater than that which rested upon Washington. Without the assistance of that divine being who ever attended him, I cannot succeed. With that assistance, I cannot fail. Trusting in him who can go with me and remain with you and be everywhere for good, let us confidently hope that all will yet be well. To his care commending you, as I hope in your prayers you will commend me, I bid you an affectionate farewell." The speech was telegraphed with substantial accuracy all over the country, and was read with loving sympathy by millions of loyal citizens. The words above given are the report as revised by Lincoln himself, and first published in the Century for December 1887. The party was in charge of Colonel Ward Hill Lehman, afterwards Marshal of the District of Columbia. He was a trained athlete, a Hercules in strength, a man who knew not what fear was, and with an enthusiasm akin to religious zeal, he was devoted to his chief, soul and body. In the words of a later marshal, he worshipped every bone in his body. A few friends had accompanied the presidential party to Indianapolis, where the first stop was made. After the address of welcome by Governor Morton and the response, after the speech to the legislature, after the reception and the handshaking, they were left in quiet in the Bates House. These friends then took Lehman into a room, locked a door, and in the most solemn and impressive manner laid upon him the responsibility of guarding Lincoln's person until they should reach Washington. The scene was concluded by DuBois with a mixture of solemnity and playfulness, who said, "Now, Lehman, we entrust the sacred life of Mr. Lincoln to your keeping, and if you don't protect it, never return to Illinois, for we will murder you on sight." Neither the exhortation nor the threat were in the least needed by Lehman, who was thoroughly alert. But it is of interest in this, that it indicates that there was a widespread feeling that this journey was fraught with unusual dangers. Of course, Lincoln made many brief speeches. These were closely scanned in the hope of finding some premonition of his inaugural, but not one such word escaped him. He complained that though he had in his day done much hard work, this was the hardest work he had ever done, to keep speaking without saying anything. It was not quite true that he did not say anything, for the speeches were thoughtful and full of interest. But he did not anticipate his inaugural, and to that the popular curiosity was alive. He did not say the things that were upmost in his mind. At Indianapolis he asked pregnant questions. What then is coercion? What is invasion? If the United States should merely hold and retake its own forts and other property in South Carolina that had seceded, and collect the duties on foreign importations, or even withhold the mails from places where they had been habitually violated, would any or all of these things be invasion or coercion? Upon what principle, what rightful principle, may a state, being no more than 1/50th part of the nation in soil and population, break up the nation and then coerce a proportionally larger subdivision of itself in the most arbitrary way? What mysterious right to play tyrant is conferred on a district of country with its people by merely calling it a state? Fellow citizens, I am not asserting anything. I am merely asking questions for you to consider. At Trenton, New Jersey, historic in the annals of the Revolutionary War, He spoke with simple candor of the influence upon his life of Weems' Life of Washington, one of the first books he ever read. The audience broke into cheers loud and long when he appealed to them to stand by him in the discharge of his patriotic duty. "I shall endeavor," said he, "to take the ground I deem most just to the North, the East, the West, the South, and the whole country. I take it, I hope, in good temper, certainly with no malice towards any section. I shall do all that may be in my power to promote a peaceful settlement of all our difficulties. The man does not live who is more devoted to peace than I am, none who would do more to preserve it. But it may be necessary to put the foot down firmly. And if I do my duty and do it right, you will sustain me, will you not?" At Philadelphia, he spoke in Independence Hall on Washington's birthday and raised a flag. "Our friends," he said of it, "had provided a magnificent flag of our country. They had arranged it so that I was given the honor of raising it to the head of its staff. And when it went up, I was pleased that it went up to its place by the strength of my own feeble arm. When, according to the arrangement, the cord was pulled, and it flaunted gloriously to the wind without an accident in the bright glowing sunshine of the morning, I could not help hoping that there was in the entire success of that beautiful ceremony at least something of an omen of what is to come." On this very day, President Buchanan, in Washington City, was apologizing for permitting the American flag to be carried at the head of a procession that was marching to celebrate the birthday of George Washington. It was at Philadelphia that matters became more exciting. At that place, they were informed of a plot to assassinate the president as he passed through Baltimore. This information came to them from a variety of sources entirely independent, and the various stories so nearly agreed in substance that they could not be disregarded. Most important of these informants was Alan Pinkerton of Chicago, one of the most famous detectives in the world. He had been personally with his assistants in Baltimore and knew the details of the plot. But Lincoln was neither suspicious nor timid, and was therefore disinclined to pay heed to the warnings of Pinkerton. At about this time, the son of William H. Seward met Lincoln with confidential communications from his father. This gave other evidences of this plot, gathered by some detectives from New York City. These two sets of detectives had worked on the case, each party entirely ignorant of the other. Both got specific evidence of the plot. It was remembered, too, that since leaving Springfield 10 days before, they had had at least two escapes. The track had been tampered with in a manifest attempt to wreck the train. A hand grenade had been found in one of the cars. It was not likely that this deadly machine was taken on the train merely for fun. The members of the party were deeply concerned about the Baltimore revelations, but it was hard to get Lincoln to take them seriously. With difficulty was he persuaded to follow Pinkerton's plan and enter Washington secretly. He consented to do this really out of consideration for the judgment of others, not that he shared their apprehension. On one thing, however, Lincoln was firm. He had made certain appointments for speaking en route which he would not abandon. His promise had been given and would be kept. One was the flag raising at Philadelphia, narrated above, and the other was to address the legislature at Harrisburg. "Both these appointments," said he, "I will keep it if it costs my life." These words suggested that he may have realized more of the danger than he was willing to show. There are also intimations of the same thing which will be noticed by the careful reader of the speeches at Philadelphia and Harrisburg. In declining to give a hint of the details of his proposed policy, he said, "It were useless for me to speak of details of plans now. I shall speak officially next Monday week, if ever. If I should not speak then, it were useless for me to do so now." Again, "If this country cannot be saved without giving up that principle, I was about to say I would rather be assassinated on this spot than surrender it." And finally, "I may have said something indiscreet, but I have said nothing but what I am willing to live by, and if it be the pleasure of Almighty God, die by." These veiled references would pass unnoticed by the crowd, but they would be perfectly intelligible to those who knew of the warnings that had just been received. Lincoln was not in the habit of using such phrases, and the fact that he used them at this particular time can hardly be explained as a mere coincidence. He took in the situation, and except for keeping the engagements already made, he submitted meekly to Pinkerton's plans. An incident occurred at Harrisburg which made a great stir in the little party. This was nothing less than the loss of the manuscript of the inaugural address. This precious document the president himself had carried in a satchel. This satchel he had given to his son Robert to hold. When Robert was asked for it, it was missing. He thought he had given it to a waiter or somebody. This was one of the rare occasions on which Lincoln lost control of his temper, and for about 1 minute he addressed the careless young man with great plainness of speech. For obvious reasons, it was not judicious to say much about this loss. The president applied to Lehman for help. "Lehman," he whispered, "I have lost my certificate of moral character written by myself. Bob has lost my gripsack containing my inaugural address. I want you to help me find it." Lehman, who knew Lincoln intimately, said that he never saw him so much annoyed, nor for the time so angry. If the address were to be published prematurely, it might be made the occasion of a vast amount of mischief. Then, too, it was the product of much painstaking thought, and he had no duplicate copy. Lincoln and Lehman instituted a search for the missing satchel and were directed to the baggage room of the hotel. Here they spied a satchel that looked like the lost one. Lincoln tried the key. It fitted. With great joy, he opened it and found within one bottle of whiskey, one soiled shirt, and several paper collars. So quickly from the sublime to the ridiculous. A little later, the right satchel was found and was not again entrusted to Robert. The president kept it in his own hands. After the nervous strain was over, the humor of the situation grew on the president, and it reminded him of a little story. A man had saved up his earnings until they reached the sum of $1,500. This was deposited for safekeeping in a bank. The bank failed, and the man received as his share 10%, or $150. This he deposited in another bank. The second bank also failed, and the poor fellow again received 10%, or $15. When this remnant of his fortune was paid over to him, he held it in his hand, looking at it thoroughly. Finally, he said, "Now I've got you reduced to a portable shape, so I'll put you in my pocket." Suiting the action to the word, Lincoln took his certificate of moral character from the satchel and carefully put it in the inside pocket of his vest. No further mishap came to that document. The journey from Harrisburg to Washington was accomplished as planned, with the assistance of certain officials of the railway and telegraph companies. First of all, the wires leading out of Harrisburg were cut, so that if Lincoln's departure were discovered, the news could not be communicated by telegraph. Then, after the reception, Lincoln, attended by Lehman, left the hotel by a side door and was driven to the railway station. Here they found waiting a special train consisting of one baggage car and one passenger car. The track was for the time kept entirely clear for this train. Arriving at Philadelphia, they stopped outside the station, where Pinkerton met them with a closed carriage in readiness. They were driven rapidly across the city to the Washington train, which had been detained a few minutes for a sick passenger and one attendant. They entered the rear door of the sleeping car. The sick passenger went to his berth at once, and the attendant gave the tickets to the conductor, who did not even see the sick passenger and who did not dream of what a precious life he was carrying. They arrived at 6 o'clock in the morning at Washington City, where they were met by Seward and Washburn and taken to Willard's Hotel. The rest of the party came on scheduled time. At Baltimore, there was a large crowd in waiting, but no disturbance. The news of the president's arrival had been telegraphed over the country, and the band of assassins were for the time helpless. Their intended victim had escaped. There was no reason why they should create a disturbance. Lincoln always regretted this secret passage. He later came to discount heavily the revelations of a professional spy. Long after, he said, "I did not then, nor do I now, believe I should have been assassinated had I gone through Baltimore as first contemplated. But I thought it wise to run no risk where no risk was necessary." It is positively asserted by Laman, who knew whereof he spake, that there was no time from the moment of leaving Springfield to his death when Lincoln was free from danger of murder. Yet he never could be prevailed upon to accept precautions. What were the reasons for his apparent carelessness? It is almost certain that he realized, more than he would have his friends know, that he was surrounded by dangers. He probably realized this more keenly than they did. They could locate specific dangers, but no man ever better understands the murderous spirit which underlay much of that hatred towards this man who had never harmed a human being. He felt that an escape from one danger might be simply running into another more deadly. It was like dodging bullets on the field of battle. He, better than they, realized that the unseen dangers were greater than those which they thought they had discovered. The only way, then, was to go straight ahead as if unmindful of all dangers. Then, too, though Lincoln could understand dangers in the abstract, his mind did not seem to be able to individualize them. He knew well that many persons wanted to kill him. But when it came to the point of the murder being done by X or Y or Z, he did not believe it possible that they would do such a thing. These explanations are suggested. There may be others. But these two conflicting and paradoxical facts must be kept in mind. All through his public life, he was oppressed with the belief that he would not live to see the end of the national crisis. On the other hand, not all the importunities of his most devoted friends could persuade him to guard himself. In the light of what we now know, it is wonderful that he escaped these plots for more than 4 years. Had he been more cautious, he might not have escaped so long. At the same time, as we shall presently see, had he heeded the last caution of his devoted friend, he would not have been shot in 1865. Chapter 22. The Inauguration. Beautiful for situation and beautiful in construction is the city of Washington today. But it was not so in Lincoln's day. The proper decoration of the city did not begin until Grant's administration. In 1861 it was comparatively a small city. Its population numbered only about 65,000. The magnificent modern residences had not been built. The houses were few, low, not handsome, with hideous spaces of unimproved land lying between. The streets were not paved with asphalt. Some were paved with cobblestones, and some consisted of plain aboriginal mud. The dome of the Capitol was but half finished when Lincoln saw it for the first time, and the huge derrick which surmounted it was painfully suggestive of the gallows. The approach was not a well-kept lawn, but a meadow of grass, ragged and ill-cared for. Washington society was then, as always, composed of people of education and social culture. But it was not such as would kindle the enthusiasm of the patriot. From the time whereof the memory of man runneth not to the contrary, it had been dominated by the slave power. The District of Columbia is situated in a slave state. The politics of South Carolina and Mississippi had always been aggressive, and the social leadership had been the same. J.G. Holland estimated that not more than 1 in 5 people of the city of Washington in the winter of 1860-61 were glad to have Lincoln come. He was not far from right. Laman called the city a focus of political intrigue and corruption. For many years, specifically since 1848, the slave power had been masterful in Washington, while its despotic temper had grown continually more assertive. The intellectual and moral atmosphere became increasingly repulsive to those who believed in freedom, and such people would not therefore choose that city as a place of residence. The departments were of course filled with employees in sympathy with slavery. Pierce had been made president in 1853. The Missouri Compromise had been repealed in 1854. Buchanan came into office in 1857. The crowning act of his administration was supporting the Kansas infamy in 1859. From these indications, it is easy to estimate the political status of Washington society when Lincoln entered the city February 23, 1861. Many thousands of his friends poured in from all quarters north of Mason and Dixon's line to attend the ceremonies of the inaugural, but these were transient and foreign to the prevailing sentiment of the city. Every official courtesy, however, was shown to the president-elect. The outgoing president and cabinet received him politely. He had many supporters and some personal friends in both houses of Congress. These received him with enthusiasm, while his opponents were not uncivil. The members of the Supreme Court greeted him with a measure of cordiality. Both Douglas and Breckinridge, the defeated candidates at the late election, called on him. The so-called peace conference had brought together many men of local influence who seized the opportunity of making his acquaintance. So the few days passed busily as the time for inauguration approached. Of course, anxiety and even excitement were not unknown. One instance is enough to relate here. Arrangements were about concluded for the cabinet appointments. The most important selection was for the Secretary of State. This position had been tendered to Seward months before and had by him been accepted. The subsequent selections had been made in view of the fact that Seward was to fill this position. On Saturday, March 2nd, while only a few hours remained before the inaugural, Seward suddenly withdrew his promised acceptance. This utterly upset the balancing on which Lincoln had so carefully worked for the last 4 months and was fitted to cause consternation. Lincoln's comment was, "I can't afford to have Seward take the first trick." So he sent him an urgent personal note on the morning of March 4th, requesting him to withdraw this refusal. Seward acceded to this, and the matter was arranged satisfactorily. The morning of the day of the inauguration was clear, mild, beautiful. The military display gave a bright and showy appearance to the scene. General Scott had used the utmost care to have the arrangements for the defense of the president perfect. There were guards about the carriage, guards about the Capitol, a flying battery upon a commanding hill. Besides this, sharpshooters were posted on the roofs of the houses along the route of travel, with injunctions to watch narrowly the window opposite and fire upon the first manifestation of disorder. One cannot resist the temptation to speculate upon the excitement that would have developed had a mischievous boy set off a large firecracker at a critical moment. Shortly after 12 o'clock noon, Buchanan called to escort his successor to the Capitol. The retiring president and the president-elect rode side by side through the streets. Reaching the ground of the Capitol, they found an improvised board tunnel through which they walked arm in arm to the building. This tunnel had been constructed to guard against assassination, of which there had recently been many threats. They passed through the Senate chamber and through the building to the large platform which had been erected at the east front. The procession was headed by the justices of the Supreme Court, clothed in cap and gown. The platform was densely packed, but in the number were four men of a special interest. When Lincoln had first been nominated for the Senate at Springfield, June 16, 1858, he made the speech which came to be known as the House Divided Against Itself speech. One remarkable paragraph is here quoted. "We cannot absolutely know that all these exact adaptions are the result of preconcert. But when we see a lot of frame timbers, different proportions of which we know have been gotten out at different times and places and by different workmen, Stephen, Franklin, Roger, and James, for instance, and when we see these timbers joined together and see they exactly make the frame of a house or a mill, all the tenons and mortises exactly fitting, and all the lengths and proportion of the different pieces exactly adapted to their respective places, and not a piece too many or too few, not omitting even scaffolding, or if a single piece be lacking, we see the place and the frame exactly fitted and prepared yet to bring the piece in such a case we find it impossible not to believe that Stephen and Franklin and Roger and James all understood one another from the beginning, and all worked upon a common plan or draft drawn up before the first blow was struck." The manifest reference here is to the co-workers for the extension of slavery, namely Stephen A. Douglas, Franklin Pierce, Roger B. Taney, and James Buchanan. One of this number, Franklin, had fallen into welcome oblivion. James had escorted Lincoln to the platform. Stephen stood immediately behind him, alert to show him any courtesy. And Roger, as Chief Justice, was about to administer the oath of office. It was a rare case of poetic justice. Lincoln was introduced to the vast audience by his former neighbor, E.D. Baker, at this time senator from Oregon. In one hand Lincoln had his silk hat, and as he looked about for a place to put it, his old antagonist, Douglas, took it. To a lady he whispered, "If I can't be president, I can at least hold the president's hat." The inaugural dress had been submitted confidentially to a few trusted friends for criticism. The only criticisms of importance were those of Seward. By these, Lincoln was guided, but not governed. A perusal of the documents will show that, while Seward's suggestions were unquestionably good, Lincoln's finished product was far better. This is specifically true of the closing paragraph, which has been widely admired for its great beauty. From the remarkable address, we quote only two passages. In the first, he meets the charge that he would involve the country in war. It is as follows. "I shall take care, as the Constitution itself expressly enjoins upon me, that the laws of the Union shall be faithfully executed in all the states. Doing this, which I deem to be only a simple duty of my part, I shall perfectly perform it, so far as is practicable, unless my rightful masters, the American people, shall withhold the requisition, or in some authoritative manner direct the contrary. I trust this will not be regarded as a menace, but only as the declared purpose of the Union that it will constitutionally defend and maintain itself. In doing this, there need be no bloodshed or violence, and there shall be none unless it is forced upon the national authority. The power confided to me will be used to hold, occupy, and possess the property in places belonging to the government, and collect the duties and impost. But beyond what may be necessary for these objects, there will be no invasion, no using of force against or among the people anywhere." Concerning the clause above italicized, there was a general questioning. Does he mean what he says? In due time they learned he meant what he said, and all of it. The address concluded as follows. "In your hands, my dissatisfied fellow countrymen, and not in mine, is the momentous issue of civil war. The government will not assail you. You can have no conflict without being yourself the aggressor. You have no oath registered in heaven to destroy the government, while I shall have the most solemn one to preserve, protect, and defend it. I am loath to close. We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection. The mystic cords of memory, stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave to every living heart and hearthstone all over this broad land, will yet swell the chorus of the Union when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature." The address was listened to closely throughout. Immediately upon its conclusion, the speaker was sworn into office by Chief Justice Taney, whose name is connected with the famous Dred Scott decision. James Buchanan was now a private citizen, and the pioneer rail splitter was at the head of the United States. In all the thousands of people there assembled, there was no one who listened more intently than Stephen A. Douglas. At the conclusion, he warmly grasped the President's hand, congratulated him upon the inaugural, and pledged to him that he would stand by him and support him in upholding the Constitution and enforcing the laws. The nobler part of the nature of the little giant came to the surface. The clearness, the gentleness, the magnanimity, the manliness expressed in this inaugural address of his old rival won him over at last, and he pledged him here his fealty. For a few months while the storm was brewing, Douglas was inactive, so that his influence counted on the side of the hostile party, the party to which he had always belonged. But when war actually broke out, he hastened to stand by the President, and right nobly did he redeem his promise which he had given. Had he lived, there are few men whose influence would have been more weighty in the cause of the Union. An untimely death cut him off at the beginning of his patriotic activity. His last public act was to address to the legislature of Illinois a masterly plea for the support of the war for the Union. He died in Chicago on the 3rd of June, 1861.
Thank you, everyone, for listening in tonight. I'd also like to remind you to listen in Sunday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time for the 104th edition of the Patriot Hour, where General Rachel and I try to make sense out of all this nonsense. And before I close out the show with Mansions of the Lord, sung by the West Point Glee Club, just want to remind you again to have your pet Muzzy spayed or neutered. Good night, everyone.